The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Goddess, sing of the cataclysmic wrath of great Achilles, son of Peleus, which caused the Greeks immeasurable pain and sent so many noble souls of heroes to Hades and made men the spoils of dogs, a banquet for the birds. Okay, I've got your attention. So, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia again. My name is Jason Freeman, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Emily Wilson. And I actually wrote that line that you just heard. She did a great translation of my words there. Referred to by The Guardian as a cultural landmark, Emily Wilson's 2017 translation of the Odyssey was hailed for its fresh and unpretentious rendition of the classical poem in modern parlance. A professor of classical studies at the University of Pennsylvania, she has also published translations of the works of Sophocles, Euripides, and Seneca, and is the author of books on the death of Socrates and the life of Seneca. She is the recipient of fellowships from the American Academy in Rome, the MacArthur Foundation, and the Guggenheim Foundation. Her latest work is a grounded yet galloping translation of the Iliad, Homer's other epic work, and one of history's most revered war poems. A New York Times review proclaims, "Wilson's translation of Homeric Greek is always buoyant and expressive," and the Washington Post calls it a genuine page-turner that balances the epic and the everyday. Exciting praise for a work that was originally written in the 8th century BCE. Tonight's author will be in conversation with Sheila Murnaghan, chair of the Classics Department at the University of Pennsylvania. She is the author of Disguise and Recognition in the Odyssey and the co-editor of Women and Slaves in Greco-Roman Culture, Differential Equations. She specializes in the areas of Greek epic, tragedy and historiography, gender and classical culture, and the classical tradition. Philadelphians, Greeks, Trojans, join me in welcoming tonight's guests.
So, Emily, I think the first thing to say is, congratulations. This is an amazing achievement, really a milestone. And I'm sure this must be for you an extremely satisfying moment, and maybe also one that's a little bit sad and even a little bit scary.
It's a very exciting moment. I mean, it is a little scary, and it feels very strange not to have another Homeric epic to go on to, and I feel very sad.
Yeah, there's not much we can do about that,
yes.
Is there?
Yes. No. Yeah. Yes. We need to bring back the cyclic poems from the dead.
So anyway, I think we agreed that the best thing is for you to start by jumping into the poem with how it begins, starting in Greek and in your translation, and then reading a bit more to give us a flavor of this translation.
So I'm going to stand at the podium just to do a little bit of reading. So you've already heard a little bit of the beginning. I'll do it. The beginning of the poem first in Greek, and then in my translation, which you've already heard a little bit of, and then I'll read a little bit more about the theme of wrath with which we begin. Men in aid at the Peleador Achilleos, Ulomenen, Hemuriaca os Algiatheca, Polas diphthimus psukas, Aidi proiapsin heron. Autus de heloria tjuke cunesin, oio nosi de daita, dios de teleito bule. Ex hu deta pruta, dias de ten ersanta, atre des ten axandron, cae dios Achilleus.
Wow.
Yeah. Thank you for clapping. It makes me feel like I didn't need to translate it because you already got it. Goddess, sing of the cataclysmic wrath of great Achilles, son of Peleus, which caused the Greeks immeasurable pain and sent so many noble souls of heroes to Hades and made men the spoils of dogs, a banquet for the birds. And so the plan of Zeus unfolded, starting with the conflict between great Agamemnon, lord of men, and glorious Achilles. So you've got the theme of wrath, which I don't want to spoil the poem for you completely, because I know some of you may not have read it, but if you haven't read it, wrath is very important. Achilles is very angry. Achilles and Agamemnon have a quarrel, which you've already got just from those first few lines. The anger of Achilles is prompted by having the woman that he's been enslaving taken from him by Agamemnon. He then devises a plan with his sea goddess mother Thetis and Zeus that he'll sit out of the battle and paradoxically cause far more deaths on his own side by not fighting than he did by fighting. So he refuses to fight for the Greek side, and the Greeks start doing terribly badly in the war, and a delegation of them come to beg him to come back. This is from Book 9. He gives a wonderful speech to Odysseus of refusal, explaining why he won't accept Agamemnon's gifts or attempts at reconciliation. So I'm just going to read a slightly abridged version of that speech, and then I'll go sit down and we can chat about it all. So this is Achilles' reply to Odysseus. Son of Laertes, favorite of Zeus, scheming Odysseus, I must speak out emphatically and unreservedly. I must tell you exactly how I feel and what the future holds for us, or else the three of you will keep on sitting there and take turns chittering and clucking at me. I hate, like Hades' gates, the man who hides one thought inside his heart and says another. So I will tell you what I think is best. I do not think the son of Atreus or any of the Greeks can change my mind, because I got no thanks for all my labors, constantly battling the enemy. A man who fights his hardest in the war gets just the same as one who stays behind. Cowards and heroes have the same reward. Do everything or nothing, death still comes. I have endured great pain. I risked my life over and over in this endless war, but I got nothing for it. As a bird brings little mouthfuls for her fledgling chicks whenever she gets food and starves herself, so I kept watch for many sleepless nights and fought my way through many bloody days, struggling with men to rob them of their women. Near fertile Troy, I looted and destroyed 12 towns by ship, 11 more on foot. From every one of them, I seized a hoard of marvelous treasure, and I brought it all back here and gave it all to Agamemnon, the son of Atreus. He stayed behind, beside his quick ships, taking everything. He kept the most, but shared a little out and handed trophies to the lords and leaders. The others still have theirs, but he took mine, just mine, from me, not anybody else's. So he insulted me, that mighty leader, that son of Atreus, that Agamemnon. Go tell him my whole answer. Let him hear it in public, so the other Greeks will also get angry with him, just in case he tries to trick another one of us in future. He always dresses in his shamelessness. He would not dare come look me in the eyes, that dog. I will not join his plans or actions. He did me wrong. He cheated me. Enough! Let him not trick me with his words again. Be gone with him. Why has Zeus so raised his wits? I hate that man's gifts, and I do not have even a scintilla of respect for him. Not even if he gave 10 times as much, or 20 times the wealth he now possesses. And even if he got yet more from somewhere, the treasure that accrues to Orchomenus, or all the riches of Egyptian Thebes, whose houses hold the richest stores, the city of seven gates, from each of which march forth 20 armed warriors with chariots. Not even if his gifts to me could match the grains of dust and sand. Not even then would Agamemnon ever sway my heart. To me, no wealth is worth a person's life. Not even all the treasure that they say the thriving town of Troy once held inside in former days of peace before we came. Nor all the riches held in rocky Delphi, behind the doorstone of the archer god, Phoebus Apollo. You can raid fine cattle or well-fed sheep, and you can trade to get tripods and horses with bright golden manes. But human life does not come back again after it passes through the fence of teeth. No trade or raiding can recover it. My silver-footed goddess mother, Thetis, says that there are two ways my death may come. If I stay here and fight besieging Troy, my chance of ever going home is lost, but I shall have a name that lasts forever. Or if I go home to my own dear country, I lose my glory, but I gain long life. Death cannot run so fast to overtake me. I would advise the rest of you as well to sail back home. You will not take tall Troy. Far-seeing Zeus has stretched his hand across it.
So great. I actually wanted to start by asking you a little bit about that amazing phrase with which you end the first line, cataclysmic wrath. And both of those words are extremely interesting and I think raise some interesting questions about your approach. So what your translations of Homer are always characterized as is straightforward, direct, plain-spoken, accessible, familiar. And yet here you're using words that are maybe not so familiar. Wrath, a very interesting choice for a word that others might translate anger or rage, because wrath is really not a word that is in common use.
No.
And cataclysmic, also a very interesting word, not a plain spoken word, a quite fancy word.
Yes. And fancy words, yes.
Yeah. And also, I feel like, you know, it's sort of interesting thinking about the Greek word that you're translating there, oulomenein. That's a word that certainly means massively destructive, but it doesn't have quite the sense, I think, that cataclysmic has for us of natural disaster. So I guess I'm curious about your choice of wrath, and then your use of cataclysmic seems to me to raise, a question about whether this is an Iliad for an era of concern about natural disaster.
I don't necessarily prioritize the chatty. I mean, writing in iambic pentameter is not a gesture towards chattiness. It's a gesture towards poetic artifice and the avoidance of all contractions. And I don't want the register to sound like normal speech at all. With the Iliad, I gave up on one of the constraints that I'd set for myself with the Odyssey was to use the same number of lines as the original. And I wrestled with whether that was possible for the Iliad, and it ended up not being possible because there were so many names. So I gave up on the line for line thing. And it actually, I think, had a very good effect on what I was able to do. It gave me more opportunity to use nice long words like cataclysmic. And I like the fact that cataclysmic has the same number of syllables as ulomenen, and it has this sort of heft to it. I mean, I played around with other possibilities in terms of four-syllable words that would feel, I mean, sometimes it's translated as deadly, but deadly doesn't sound very deadly. I mean, I think it really needs to be a word that sounds as if this is going to be destroying in a very large-scale way. Wrath, I chose wrath rather than anger or rage, and I consistently do wrath for menis and menimos, and the many cognate terms that there are for that particular category of anger in the poem, because it seemed to me really important to be precise, as the original is, about how Achilles' wrath is different from normal human anger. There are other words for, like kolos, for normal human anger, or passion, or aggression, or rage. But the wrath of Achilles is more like divine anger, in that it causes not just Achilles directly killing a few people, but that even at a distance he can kill. So in that sense, he's like Apollo. So I wanted this, the connotation of this is more than normal getting grumpy. This is like something really, really important biblical level of anger.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So my next question comes sort of from the passage that you read from Achilles. I think that teaching the Iliad to students or to talking about the Iliad, one reaction that people really often have is that these heroes seem to modern people kind of petty. Mm-hmm. You hear childish a lot. They seem to care, and here are these, you know, extremely rich, extremely privileged people who, as Achilles is saying, have a lot of stuff, and yet they seem to care about a lot more stuff. And then, you know, they also seem to be willing to, I mean, Achilles is willing to allow many people on his own side to die out just because of his anger at Agamemnon. You know, if you talk about the Iliad with people who have a kind of military orientation, there are, people who have modern military experience are always shocked at a commander who will let his men die. So I'm just wondering how you respond to that and how you think of your translation as responding to that.
Yes. I mean, I respond to it partly by thinking that feels to me too fast. I mean, I think while you're in the world of the Homeric poem, I don't think you're invited to sort of use those judgmental terms like petty or petulant or being in a sulk. I mean, these various terms which I think readers may tend to think if they hear the plot summary of the poem rather than be immersed in how sympathetic the Homeric narrative is to the feelings. And I think one can also feel that the feelings are real even if you don't think, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to be led into battle by Achilles, but I also don't think that that means that we can't allow our imaginative sympathies to be big enough to accommodate feeling for him, and also feeling how closely intertwined his awareness of his own mortality is. I mean, some of those most powerful lines in that speech are sort of telling these hard truths about life doesn't come back once it's escaped the fence of teeth, and he knows how many horses you can get by rustling, because he's been doing that for the last 9 years. He knows how much stuff you can gather, and yet life isn't that, like that. You can't gather life back again once it's escaped from you. And I think that's just so powerful and truthful, and it applies to the very privileged and the not very privileged as well. I mean, I also think that the poem is so smart about how if you have so much, then any kind of diminution in status and honor matters an enormous amount. I mean, if you're trying to be the very best, then something that shows you might not be the very best is terrifying. So I think it sort of makes sense within the poem's world and within the poem's social world that it does actually matter. It's not trivial.
So now a different kind of question. I think, you know, every time you come back to a poem like this, there's always something surprising in it. And in translating the Iliad, you were coming back to a poem you've known for a long time, but immersing yourself in it really as closely as anyone can. I mean, really engaging with every single word. So I'm curious, what were the things that you found most surprising coming to the Iliad as its translator?
It's a good question, but it's also such a difficult one, because it's hard to reconstruct. What did I not remember that I 3 years ago that now I think seems central? And yes, I mean, to me, partly it was sort of realizing characters that I somewhat neglected were so fascinating. I mean, just sort of thinking through Iris, the messenger goddess, is so great. And I think I hadn't fully thought through what a great character she is in every scene that she appears in. Thinking also just about the ways, I mean, I was already very much aware of how fascinating the poem is as a representation of a soundscape and of the noisiness of the battle. But I hadn't sort of had to wrestle with how might I convey that in English, and how many more words are there for very loud screaming that doesn't sound ridiculous or cartoonish. I was sort of always sort of trying to find words in English that would match the range of Homeric vocabulary about screaming or about glitteriness. Both of which are not necessarily usable words in most of the contexts that I wanted to use them. I mean, ow, 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 is that something I can have them say? And yet Ron constantly wants words a bit like that.
Yeah. Well, can you tell us just a little bit more about your process? You know, what was involved day by day as you were working on this? Did you begin at the beginning and go straight through? Were you able to work on it for long stretches, or was that difficult?
Yes, so I did begin at the beginning, and I went almost straight through, but not entirely, because the Norton Anthology of World Literature, which I'm also involved with, has an abridged version of the Iliad, which predictably, as with every abridged version, it's the story of Achilles. So it slices, I kind of hate that. I was wishing that we could suggest a different abridgment and just have the story of Hector and cut out Achilles. But that wasn't obviously what we're going to do. So that meant that I had to do book 22 and book 24 earlier and then go back and fill in the parts in between with the great battle later. I mean, in terms of process, I mean, it got easier over the years. The first couple of years were really hard, and I kept feeling like I'm producing these drafts, and I'm just stuck all the time, and I was wrestling with things like how long should the lines be, and that kind of thing. It felt like endlessly, and then once I was about 3 years in, it seemed to get much, much easier, and I felt I suddenly had got a voice for it. I did a lot of reading out loud, I did a lot of reading my drafts out loud, I did a lot of writing a draft by hand and then playing around with it and trying out the sounds of it. And then multiple stages of revision too. I mean, you and I have talked before about just how essential revision is for every kind of writing, but I think translation most of all. It's a writing where the first draft is never the final draft.
So I think that point about how the Iliad gets reduced to the story of Achilles. Mm-hmm. I mean, what you said about all the other characters mm-hmm. that you noticed. I mean, this is a poem whose central figure is out of the action for a huge section of it, and that really opens it up mm-hmm. To all kinds of other characters, and lots of other warriors get their opportunity. Mm-hmm. But one thing about the Iliad, you read that passage where Achilles says he's not going to fight mm-hmm. and he's going to go home instead. But of course, he's not able to do that. Mm-hmm. He can't stay away from the battlefield. And this poem can't stay away from the battlefield for very long. Mm-hmm. And really long stretches of it are battle scenes. Mm-hmm. And you've already mentioned some of the particular challenges of translating those, but I think we agreed that it would be good if you now read a scene from the battlefield.
I'll do a scene from the battlefield, and you'll also hear that even when we're in the battlefield, there are similes that take you outside the battlefield as well. I mean, the challenges of translation also include the way the Iliad is always moving between worlds, and it's moving both between the divine and the human, between the Trojan and the Greek, and then also between the world where we are in the war and the world where we aren't, the world of the woods or the agriculture or whatever else there is in the similes. That's enough. Good. Okay, so we had Achilles and his wrath, and now we will have a battlefield scene as... So in the absence of Achilles, Hector, the great Trojan warrior... manages to advance towards the Greek ships, but the Greek forces have a strong defense, and I will read a passage of battlefield sequence in which Hector gets very badly wounded. And this is from book 14. When every man was dressed in shining bronze, they charged ahead, led by the god of earthquakes, Poseidon. In his sturdy hand, he held a deadly, sharp-edged sword that shone like lightning. It is decreed that nobody may fight this terrifying blade in bitter battle. Fear seizes every man when it appears. And meanwhile, on the other side, great Hector marshaled the Trojan troops. Blue-haired Poseidon and noble Hector pulled the rope of war, creating an intense and dreadful conflict. One led the Trojans and one helped the Greeks. The sea surged up towards the huts and ships. The armies clashed with a tumultuous cry. Louder than roaring of the waves on shore, when cruel blasts of Boreas have stirred the deepest water, louder than the rumble of blazing fire that leaps to burn a forest within the thickets on the mountainside, louder than wind that shrieks through lofty oak trees, which roars the loudest when it rages most. Louder than all of these, the Greeks and Trojans let out their terrifying screams and cries as they attacked each other. Shining Hector aimed with his spear at Ajax, who had turned to face him head on. Hector did not miss. He struck the straps across the chest of Ajax, which held his shield and silver-studded sword. The son of Telamon had tied them on, and they protected his soft flesh. Then Hector was angry that his sharp spear caused no damage. Frustrated, he rejoined his group of comrades. But mighty Ajax, son of Telamon, hit him as he retreated with a stone. Numerous rocks, the swift ship's anchor stones, rolled at the fighter's feet, and Ajax seized one of these stones and hurled it straight at Hector over his shield rim, and it hit his chest under his throat and sent him whirling round, just as a spinning top is struck and spun, as when the father Zeus strikes down and fells an oak tree by the roots, and as it falls, there is a strange, uncanny smell of sulfur, and anyone who sees it is afraid. So swiftly Hector tumbled to the ground, the mighty fighter fallen in the dust. His spear fell from his hand. His shield and helmet crashed down on top of him, and round his body, his fine bronze armor clattered. So this is a little bit of a cliffhanger, because it sounds for a moment as if Hector's dead, but it's only halfway through the poem, so it's not actually the case that he's dead. But I'm going to read a second passage, if that's all right, just
yes.
As a sort of pair. So the Iliad has massacre scenes, wounding scenes, exciting battle scenes. Hector does actually die in the end. Achilles does return to battle eventually after the death of his own dearest friend Patroclus, and kills Hector, who killed Patroclus. I wanted to illustrate both the fighting sequences and the ways that the Iliad is a poem also of grief as well as of anger. So I'm going to read the sequence in which Hector's wife Andromache discovers that her husband, whom she pleaded with not to leave the safer space on the city walls to go out on the plain to fight Achilles, Hector refused her pleas and those of his parents, went out and is now dead. So this is the sequence in which Andromache sees her husband's body being dragged around the city walls and desecrated by Achilles. The wife of Hector, so far, still knew nothing. No messenger had come to bring the news that he had stayed outside beyond the gates. Up in an inner chamber of the house, she wove a double-layered purple cloth, and in it stitched elaborate designs. She called the house slaves with their braided hair to heat a mighty tripod on the fire so that the washing water would be hot for Hector when he came back home from battle. Poor fool, she did not know that very far from any bath, he was already dead. Bright-eyed Athena, through Achilles' hands, had brought him down. Then, from the wall, she heard keening and groans of grief. Her body trembled. She dropped her shuttle to the ground and called again to the women slaves with braided hair and told them, "Hurry, two of you, come with me so I can see what happened. I just heard the voice of noble Hecuba. My heart is jumping through me to my mouth. My legs are paralyzed. Some trouble must be near the sons of Priam. Let my ears not hear it. I have a dreadful fear that great Achilles has intercepted Hector by himself and driven him from a city to the plain and robbed him of the ruinous rash courage that once possessed him that caused so much pain. He never stayed among the mass of troops. He always hurtled far ahead, aggressive and giving way to no one." So she spoke and dashed all through the palace like a Maenad with pounding heart. Her women slaves ran with her. She reached the wall and crowd of men and stood high on the battlements to look for him. She saw him being dragged before the city, dragged to the hollow ships by running horses who took no care to tend him properly. Then black night veiled her eyes. She toppled backward and breathed her spirit out. She tossed away the shining knotted headdress from her head, the circlet veil, well-braided band and scarf that golden Aphrodite gave to her the day that Hector of the glittering helmet paid lavish bridal gifts to lead her off in marriage from the house of Eetion. Andromache was stunned as if to death. The women of her husband's family clustered around and held her in their midst. When she had caught her breath and woken up, she raised her voice to sing in lamentation among the women and the girls of Troy. Hector, my life is over. You and I were both born for this selfsame destiny. You were born here in Troy, in Priam's house, but I was raised in Thebe, underneath the forests of Mount Placus, and my father, Eetion, cared for me when I was little. His luck was bad and mine was ruination. If only he had never had a daughter. Now you have gone beneath the depths of earth into the house of Hades, and you leave me in bitter grief, a widow in your halls. Our son is still a little baby, born to such unlucky parents, you and me. You will not help him now that you are dead, Hector, nor will he you. If he escapes this world of tears, this war against the Greeks, trouble and pain will be with him forever.
It's really amazing to see those two passages side by side, because there's Hector
almost dead, and she almost dies too.
And then, of course, he goes on to die, but she goes on to have the future that she fears. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing that really seems to come out there is something that, you know, this nexus between grief and wrath, mm-hmm. That anger is really stoked by loss.
Yes.
In that early speech of Achilles that you were reading, you could feel the pain of what he'd lost. Mm-hmm. But here, interesting, Andromache seems to be both angry at Hector and for leaving her, and grieving at the same time, so they kind of come together. And you see grief leading, not as in the case of Achilles, who's really drawn into battle by grief for Patroclus, leading not to action, but to a form of song.
To lament, yes. I mean, I wrestled with how much can I use the word keening. I mean, the language of grief is so important in the Iliad, and the ways that women's grief is different from male grief and expressed in different ways with different gestures, different words, and also different possibilities, because, of course, Andromache will soon be enslaved. She doesn't have the possibility to go out and kill Achilles. That's not an option for her.
Yeah.
It was an option for Achilles to go out and kill the killer of his beloved, but it's not possible for Andromache. So all she has left is this language, and the language both of attempted persuasion, which she's tried, which has failed, and now the language that's left is the song of lamentation.
Yeah.
And also of prayer, and the pathos of that prayer, I just ended with the hopes for the baby. And of course we know, and any ancient listener to the poem would know, that baby's going to get thrown from the city walls. That baby is not going to survive.
It really reminds you that this is a poem with many traditional sources too, mm-hmm. that this is, you know, comes out of a long tradition of heroic poetry, but it really draws on lament, mm-hmm. as well, which is really a much more of a woman's genre than heroic poetry.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And it includes a sort of the language of insult, which is tied up with the language of anger, right?
Yeah.
But then it also, which of course is also an ancient poetic tradition, the poetics of insult and the poetics of trying to find good comic/infuriating ways of mocking your opponent. And shame, of course, is the other side of the poetics of honor. But then it also has the poetics of lament, and which is, as you say, such a predates the Iliad by many centuries.
And the reminder of insult, it sort of takes us back to what we were saying about you may be kind of riding high, but you're always subject to feeling like you don't have enough. I mean, insult is a wonderful way, mm-hmm. of making people feel like they don't have enough. And mm-hmm. the Iliad really deploys that.
You never have
enough. Yes.
Because also the mortals in this poem, even the most powerful, and of course Achilles is the son of a goddess, he's the closest a mortal could be to being more than a human, and yet he's still mortal. So there's never enough.
Going back for a moment to that battle scene, what really does come through there is what a sort of multi-sensory, mm-hmm. experience going to battle with Homer is, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it really is, yes.
Yeah,
it's both the noise and the feelings in the body and the sensations on the skin and also the emotional experience.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and I was really fascinated by that simile that brings in smell, mm-hmm. the smell
yes.
of sulfur.
Yes.
Really, really striking. And also, just such a simple thing. I mean, one of the sort of constant themes of the Iliad is armor,
mm-hmm.
Yes. and these warriors are so involved with their armor. And just in that little brief passage, you saw both Ajax being protected by his mm-hmm. armor, and then Hector falling and his armor clattering on top of him.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. And which it's a traditional trope in the poem that when a warrior falls, there's the line of the armor clattering around him as he falls. And armor is so rarely does any good. And yet people
yeah.
spend so much time putting it on, and it matters so much. And it matters both for the glory, but also because of going out naked is even worse.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's not
yeah.
like, yes.
Yeah. But yeah, yes. but it
but
really...
other than also just the vulnerability of Hector's there wearing, obviously wearing his glorious helmet as he always is, and all these layers of equipment and shield as well, and yet a little stone from his own native country can get over the rim.
Yeah,
and so I think there's a sort of extra level of pathos that it's a stone from the plain of Troy that first wounds Hector.
Yeah, yeah,
he should have the home team advantage, and yet even the plain can turn against him.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has that vulnerable spot where yes. the spear finds its way in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely,
yeah.
yes.
We've been talking a lot about this nexus of grief and anger or mm-hmm. wrath, but the way it is really almost a force of nature mm-hmm. in the poem. But of course, one of the things the poem is also very aware of is that even the most cataclysmic wrath ultimately runs its course,
mm-hmm.
That it can't go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we thought that you might end by reading a passage that kind of addresses that.
Yes, sure, I'll do that. So Achilles is angry and wrathful for a very long time. He's wrathful first against Agamemnon and then against Hector. And then even once he's killed Hector and even once he's dragged and desecrated his body, even once he's held a lavish funeral for Patroclus, including human sacrifice, even once he's had very lavish funeral games in which everyone's a winner, unlike in the war, even after that, he still doesn't want to give up his anger or give the body of his murdered enemy, Hector, his slaughtered enemy, back to his family, until the gods intervene and Achilles also says he's thought it over, he will give back the body of Hector to the grieving father of Hector, Priam, who comes on a dangerous mission through the enemy camp to beg his son's killer to return the body. During the period of his rage and grief for the dead Patroclus, Achilles has been refusing to eat, even though he's had a sort of ambrosial drip from the UV from the gods. And this is the turning point, because I was thinking that probably many of you will want to go out for dinner after this, so this is when Achilles decides to eat. And this is a version of Achilles where he's giving up his anger, and he's speaking to Priam. Now your son has been released to you, just as you asked. He lies upon a bier, and when dawn shows her light, you will see him yourself and take him home. But now we need to turn our minds to dinner. Remember, even noble Niobe took thought of food, although she lost 12 children, 6 daughters, 6 strong sons inside her house. Apollo shot his silver bow and killed the sons in anger at the woman's boasting, while Artemis, who takes delight in arrows, destroyed the daughters, because Niobe compared herself to Leto, who, she said, gave birth to only 2, while she herself had mothered many children. Then those 2, small as their number was, destroyed them all. 9 days the children lay, besmeared in blood, with nobody to bury them, because Zeus turned the population into stone. But on the 10th day, the Olympian gods buried them, and then Niobe took thought of eating. She was tired of shedding tears. Now on the lonely peaks among the rocks upon Mount Sipylus, where goddesses have their abodes, or so they say, the nymphs who dance around the river Achelous, great Niobe, although she is a rock, consumes the sorrows sent her by the gods. Come then, my lord, let us remember also to eat. Then later, you will take to Troy the son you loved so much and weep for him. Certainly, he will cause you many tears.
Wow. I think that's such an amazing passage where your simplicity of language really comes through very powerfully. I find this, she was tired of shedding tears, is so so resonant, mm-hmm. Just at a certain point, no matter how mm-hmm. terrible.
You might be all cried out.
Yeah.
But also I love that it's so ambiguous in a way that feels so truthful, because Niobe is... We're told she eats, and yet she's consuming sorrows, and she's a rock forever. Grief
yeah.
never ends, and yet sometimes you have to have dinner.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that also seems, well, I think, so truthful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. and as he says, you know, when you'd go to Troy, I mean, then the mourning for Hector will start up again, and
yes.
certainly he will cause you many tears. Mm-hmm. So it's
not a happy ending, in any sense.
Oh, no, not, yeah. Yeah, not at all.
It is at least a pause in that phase of the wrath. And there's
yeah.
going to be more killing, and there's going
yeah.
to be more anger,
yeah.
and more
yeah.
grief.
Yeah. yeah, at least it has a kind of rhythm
yeah.
to it that comes to a close.
Yes, and also a restoration of the norms of how do we deal with death, that there's a giving up on the desecration of the dead body.
Right.
He's allowing burial.
Yeah, yeah, and really...
That doesn't mean that people won't be killed again, but they will at least perhaps be buried.
Yeah, yeah, and he realizes that he can only kill Hector once.
Yes.
Yeah, he mm-hmm. can't just keep...
There isn't an infinity of wrath or an infinity of grief or an infinity of killing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think at this point we're going to open it up to questions from the audience.
Could you please talk a little bit about the well-known previous translations and how much of them you read in your youth and then in your three-year journey or four-year journey of writing this at any time? Did you feel safe enough to go back and look at some of them?
yeah, it was actually a six-year journey, and it feels like it's a multi-decade journey because, of course, I've been reading this poem and thinking about translation also for many years. I grew up in Britain, as you might have guessed from how I talk, and so I read classics at Oxford, but we were never told to read translations, and so I read Homer in Greek, and I was never sort of told you must read this or that translation. So I read Homer, you know, for the first time before going up to Oxford in Greek. And then, of course, I've had many decades of teaching at Penn, and I've taught Homer in translation in several different translations. I mean, one of my motives for doing these translations at all was feeling that many of them have many merits. I mean, many of them work in the classroom in many different ways, but none of them have regular meter, none of the 20th century ones that are regularly used. In some different world, I can imagine using the Chapman translation, even though it has nothing to do with the Greek in many cases, or the Pope translation, which has equally little to do with the Greek, because I think they're great poetry. I don't think any of the 20th century translations sort of convey the rhythmicality and the music of the original in the way that I was wanting it to be conveyed to the students. While I was working on my Homer translations, I tended not to look at other translations because I wanted to try to come to my own ideas about what I wanted to do with some knotty phrase or other. I mean, I did a lot of reading commentaries and rereading the dictionary, but I didn't do looking at lots of other translations because I just thought, if I do that, then maybe I'll learn that so-and-so has done this, and then I can't use that because that would be stealing. And it just rules things out rather than expanding my options. So I didn't do a lot of looking at other translations. Though occasionally I did it slightly more with the Iliad than I didn't really do it at all with the Odyssey. With the Iliad, when I was agonizing about where should the English stress go on that name, then I would sometimes look at some of the 18th and 19th century metrical translations to see where earlier poetic translators might have put the stress, and it was usually completely useless because, of course, the English language has changed and we wouldn't necessarily say Diomede nowadays.
I wonder if you found much in the women in the poem to tease out at all. Obviously, they're not front and center, really, but did you find there were certain elements of their thinking or their feelings that maybe some of the male translators had not picked up on in the past?
So there is there's an earlier Iliad translation into English by a woman, Caroline Alexander, so I sort of don't want to pretend that there's something special about me being a woman. I mean, I don't feel that I've done enough research to answer that question. Because it would take, sort of building off my answer to the previous question, I haven't sort of done a research process of looking very closely at all 100 or however many there are English translations and sort of combing them for gender norms. I find all the characters super interesting, including the goddesses, including the mortal women. I think Homer sort of has this amazingly expansive sort of empathetic vision whereby all of the characters are real, no matter what their genders or mortality or immortality status may be. One sort of little nugget is that it was surprising to me to realize, sort of looking at the various translations of when Helen speaks about herself and uses the word kunops, kunopidos. I've looked at, I think, 4 or 5 translations by American men, which translate that word, which literally means dog face, by something or other that has sexual judgment about it. So as slut or as wanton or as whore that I am, Helen says in one of them. And I didn't think of doing that because that's not what it means. But I don't think I had to be a woman not to think of doing that. You know, I don't think that was sort of the magic of my girliness. It just doesn't mean that.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It was quite exciting. In your introduction to the Odyssey, you raised the question of who was Homer? Was there such a person? And how did the writing occur? By oral tradition? By committee? Over centuries? How would you explain that?
I don't think writing can occur by oral tradition. I think there was certainly, it's unarguable that there was a very long oral tradition, which lies in the background of the Odyssey and the Iliad. There was no writing for many centuries in archaic Greece. And then writing came in the 8th century. And at some point after the development of the Greek alphabet, these two monumental poems were composed in writing, using writing, with writing, as written artifacts that we have. There's a lot of scholarly debate about to what extent were they then altered in the course of the succeeding centuries. I tend to think there's not that much evidence for radical change over the course of the succeeding centuries. The question of, was it one person, was it an oral bard who then became literate and realized you can use this new technology to do something like the oral performances we've been doing already, but do it at a much grander scale? Because, of course, the Iliad is too long for normal after-dinner entertainment. It's too long for the sort of length that you would normally expect an audience to sit still, even an ancient audience used to experiencing oral poetry as a primary form of entertainment. There were different theories about, could it have been dictated? Could it have been some group of, was it one person who did the Odyssey and the Iliad? I kind of feel that without a time machine, I don't think we can fully answer those questions. I think we can come up with more or less plausible ideas about what's possible. There's been also a lot of really interesting comparative work about oral traditions around the world, and I think one of the big takeaways from that is they're all very different, and therefore it's actually not really the case that you can do as much as you might hope of. You find one oral tradition, and can we then use that to deduce everything about Homer? Maybe not, because there are other oral traditions which are different, so I don't know. I think it's very interesting, and it tells us a lot about why are the Homeric poems the way they are. For instance, the repeated epithets are the result of the oral poetic heritage, so they bear the marks of oral composition even within these written compositions.
Thank you for your presentation. Helen in the Odyssey and Helen in the Iliad are two entirely different individuals as I see them, but I would love to hear your comparing and contrasting the two individuals. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, they're fascinating, and I'm not sure. I think they're two. They're a character in two very different situations, right? Helen, when she's surrounded by people who are shuddering at her and saying that they wish she was gone and that she'll bring retribution upon them, and nobody's nice to her except Hector, who dies, and Priam, who's soon going to be dead. She's in a very vulnerable position in the Iliad, whereas in the Odyssey, she's back home. She's the hostess with the mostess. She has the best drugs. She's able to give the best gifts, including the fancy wedding dress to the awkward young Telemachus for the girlfriend he doesn't yet have. So she's in a position of power, and she's able to use her storytelling abilities to entertain her guests and manipulate her image in the Odyssey. It seems to me that in the Iliad too, you can see the cleverness of Helen. You can see her insight. You can see that in the scene in which she's pointing out to Priam who are all the Greek commanders, she knows everybody. She can recognize everybody. She can also construct a story about the whole narrative of which she's a central part. And I think that's the case for Helen in both of these great poems. I mean, of course, there's a way that the Iliad Helen is full of anxiety and regret and also is encountering the terrifying goddess Aphrodite, who refuses her pleas not to go to bed with Paris after he's just been humiliated in the duel with Menelaus. She doesn't want to go, but the goddess led the way. So I think we see Helen in the Iliad in a state of disempowerment that's very different from her context in the Odyssey.
Hi. Just thinking about that phrase that we talked about at the beginning, cataclysmic wrath. I think cataclysma derives from Greek and wrath from Old English and Germanic. And I'm just wondering, is that an intentional play combining the classical and the Germanic for an English translation? And did you have a lot of fun or pay attention to the origin of words that you used in certain instances like that?
That's a great question. I mean, I did definitely feel that, I mean, especially because I had the syllables to play around with to have more long words, it was possible to do more of the juxtapositions of long words in English very often tend to be Latinate in origin, if they're not, I mean, fewer of them come from Greek, but many of our longest words come from the Latin tradition through some means or other. And so there were very often contexts when it was possible to sort of achieve some kind of juxtaposition. I mean, as in, I can't think of good instances of myself doing it in other instances, but I'm sure that without quite thinking of it in those terms, when I'm sort of trying to create a sound effect through the accumulation of both some long words, but then sometimes the action needs to slow down or there needs to be a hard, heart-stopping thud, then you may need to intersperse Anglo-Saxon origin or Norman origin words with longer Latinate words. Yeah.
Hi. Many in the room, I'm sure, have read your translation of Odyssey, loved it. Compared to that translation, you mentioned the lines not matching in this, you mentioned the emphasis. What else was different in your process, in the final outcome, mm-hmm. in the approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think that using more lines had a lot of other effects that I hadn't quite predicted when I let myself use more lines. I mean, I think it, as I've said, allowed me to use more long words. It allowed me to be at least a notch more repetitive about how I handled the epithets. I mean, I have a lot of swift-footed Lord Achilles, and then he's going to be swift-footed Lord Achilles again, and he's swift-footed again, especially when he's sitting there doing nothing and his feet are not moving. He's always swift-footed Achilles. And that obviously is reflecting something in the Greek, that he's repeatedly swift-footed Achilles. And I felt that I had more syllables to play with, so I could do more of those long renditions of the great Homeric formulae. I think the mood of the Iliad is very, very different, and I wanted there to be, I mean, I hope there were some funny moments in the Iliad, but it's not a laugh a line. And the Odyssey has, you know, more movement across space and also more awkward social interactions. The ancient discourse about the Odyssey being a sort of domestic comedy of manners, and it's not exactly a comedy, but just that it has a lot of focus on people interacting with each other without having very sharp weapons in their hands. Whereas in the Iliad, when people are talking to each other, it's usually right before one of them starts killing the other. And so that just makes a big difference to the whole mood. And also, I think one of the big challenges also was just, I mean, one of the things I love most about the Iliad is how many divine interactions there are and how much movement of gods through space there is, how many different divine characters there are. And so there was a sort of different kind of challenge, whereas with the Odyssey, I thought a lot about how can I make the manifestations of Athena feel fully real, and she's transforming, and then everyone's surprised, and here she is, there she isn't. Is she a human being? No, she's a goddess. Is she a bird? No, she's a goddess. And that happens repeatedly in the Odyssey. But with the Iliad, it's all these different ways that the different gods move, that Apollo has to feel very different in how he moves through space and how he causes devastation in humanity from the ways that Poseidon causes devastation and the ways that Zeus causes devastation. Each of them can be utterly destructive, but totally different kinds of power. And I wanted the reader to be able to feel the power.
Okay, so I think that brings the formal part of our proceedings to a close. So can we just once again thank and congratulate Emily for this amazing...
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.